Well, briefly, I'd like to introduce Juan Rangel. As you can see in the program, he is the CEO, leader of UNO, United Neighborhood Organization. It's one of Chicago's largest, no, I believe it is Chicago's largest Hispanic civic organization. It was started in 1984. Mr. Rangel joined it in 1989 and took over in 1996. Currently runs 9 charter schools serving 4,500 students in the greater Chicago metropolitan area, principally located in southwestern Chicago. But wherever there's a need due to overcrowding in the public schools, UNO will appear. Provide comprehensive education, K through 12, strong character formation, and a real emphasis on American civics and citizenship and assimilation. It's a deeply moving and inspiring model for what is really a coming demographic reality, as we heard last night from Mr. Mazuka. It's something the Boy Scouts are aware of, something that America is aware of, that there is this rising population of young Hispanics, and it is the duty of Americans everywhere to be engaged and to bring them to the full blessings of American citizenship. His efforts have been recognized by the Manhattan Institute, which in 2009 awarded Mr. Rangel and UNO one of their social entrepreneurship awards, the William E. Simon Prize for Social Entrepreneurship, which is a great honor. And it is our great honor to welcome him here to share some of his thoughts about charter education in the charter school context, civic participation, and assimilation into American citizenship. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Make my way over here. It might be easier to be heard as people trickle in. We'll move around. First of all, thank you very much to the Philanthropy Roundtable and to Anna Meyerson for the invitation to be here. As we mentioned, my name is Juan Rangel. I'm the CEO of UNO, United Neighborhood Organization. And as you saw in your program, we're described as an Alinsky-inspired community organization, and that has a lot of connotations these days across the country. And it was interesting as I received my award from the Manhattan Institute, and if you know the Manhattan Institute's a fairly conservative crowd, and I was introduced as a person who began his career community organizing in the south side of Chicago, and so I could hear the rumblings in the crowd. I felt I had to explain myself a little bit. UNO has a rich tradition in Chicago of 26 years doing just that, community organizing. But I think the story of the organization is also the story of our community, and one that we feel is a very inspirational story. If you think of this large Hispanic community anywhere across the country, and you think of it in the terms of what every immigrant group has brought to this country. These are people that come here with very little, people that risk a lot and give up a lot in order to come here, seeking the one thing that this country affords us is simply the opportunity to get ahead. And that's how we see the Hispanic community, those terms. We tend to use words that are provocative. And that's in line, I think, with the Alinsky model, but maybe we take it in a very different way of using the word assimilation. Assimilation these days is a dirty word. It's viewed as a politically incorrect word. It suggests that assimilation is one that requires people to give up their language, their customs, their traditions, and all that in order to become American. And we don't see it in those terms. We see assimilation as an important part of a process that engages people in American civic life and certainly understanding the principles behind what this country is all about. We think our community fits right very well within that context. Coming from Chicago, I always joke about Chicago is a very rich city because of all the different ethnic groups that it comprises. We have the largest Polish community outside of Warsaw. We have a very healthy Irish community and Italian and Greek community, Chinese community. And the Mexican community, which happens to be about 83% of the population in Chicago, is one more that that group coming to this country. Mind you, a very large group, which I think causes the concern that you might hear across the country. UNO's thinking has evolved over time. The organization began as a community organizing entity looking to build leadership, local leadership within the community. But I think over time, we recognize that this community, the Hispanic community, even though we might characterize it as a minority community, and even though we will say we're the largest minority in the country these days, it doesn't fit the caricature of what we consider a minority group. And by that, I simply mean that the term minority has come to mean something else. It's no longer just about numbers. It really becomes a philosophy that it's somehow being a minority implies, or as people use the term, people of color, which is a word term I don't like, but people use that, that somehow because these are folks that are a minority, that it implies that somehow they've been victimized. And you have that philosophy. And they're disadvantaged and they're in need of some entitlement program. And I think UNO started kind of with that kind of mentality at first, because it's in the nature of community organizations to think of a community in terms of in need. And if you think of Alinsky's words, it's the have-nots versus the haves and all that. And clearly, this is a community of have-nots, a community that doesn't have the power and all that, as Alinsky would describe. We just don't see it in the terms of a victimized population. And we see this community with the lens of, it's actually a pretty good community. There's a community that comes here looking to take advantage of that opportunity that this country affords it. And it has all the right elements for the next successful middle class and upper class as well. If you think of the community in terms of having, think about it. This is a community that has a tremendous work ethic. This is a community that has, it was very entrepreneurial. You see business thriving. Chicago Sun-Times Sunday's headline, big bold headline, talking about the Hispanic business boom in the state of Illinois that has increased tremendously in the last decade. So it's a very entrepreneurial community, very family oriented, very traditional in the sense of family and customs and traditions. Religious, to some degree, I guess, pretty much still somewhat of a monolithic Catholic community, although there's a growing movement that's challenging that notion. Still very much a two-parent household in a community with that work ethic, very low unemployment considering the times that we live in. We see it as having all the right ingredients for a community to succeed. But you have major problems within this community. You have a severe dropout rate. In some cases, some high schools have close to 54% dropout rates. Gangs and gang violence within our community. You have teen pregnancy, alcoholism, and other vices within that. So there are challenges, but we don't see it in terms of a minority community. If you think of those challenges that we have, I don't think they're that different than any other experience from previous immigrant groups that have come to this country. And so we chose to look at the Hispanic community through that lens, with that focus, that there are challenges, challenges that could be overcome, and how you overcome them, I think, is the most important thing for us. And really seeing this community as the next great American success story. And if you think of it in those terms, all of a sudden it lifts a whole level of possibilities of what you can do with this community, this Hispanic immigrant community, which across the country, most of them are from Mexico. The vast majority are from Mexico. So we started to rethink what we do as a community organization. It wasn't just about let's fight the power, let's that kind of thing. It's really about how do we take ourselves as an organization and not only challenge the system to address issues within our community, but how do we challenge our own community to step up to another level? And that's where we see the value in an organization like UUNA, of putting a little bit more of a balance to the discussion and debate around immigrants, immigration, and certainly the empowerment of this community, and how do you challenge it to step up and fulfill that promise, that great promise of an immigrant class. And we've seen it before. And I think that the stories you hear today about Arizona and all these different controversies around immigration, they're not unique to Hispanic, to the Hispanic community. These are stories that we've heard over time. And coming from Chicago, we look at the Irish community as a pretty good model of empowerment. And here's a community that came to this country with very little. Think of the Irish community. And if there is a community that's been discriminated against and that has been viewed in a very negative light in its early days, that's one of the communities that has suffered much. Yet in Chicago, if you know Chicago politics, the Irish run everything. And there's something to be said for that empowerment model. And so that's how we choose to look at our community as to what are the possibilities here. I always say we have the right ingredients for success. I talked about the family. I talked about tradition and the work ethic and entrepreneurial community. So how do you build on those assets and how do you challenge this community? Well, for starters, at the very basic level, the foundation is our schools. The public school system in our country does a disservice to that kind of community. Rather than being aspirational, it's very demoralizing. Again, we have big problems with the school system. It's not necessarily a Hispanic issue. It's a problem with the public education as a whole. And I think you could say that at some point in our history, you can get by without an education. In Chicago, and certainly places like Gary, Indiana, and others, you can survive at the steel mills with a good-paying job. You can, family can survive and thrive and do well. It's hard to say you can do that these days. And so education needs to become a priority for everybody if communities are going to succeed. In fact, I would say that, as some have argued, that it's not so much the immigrant community that has changed us. It's just that the rest of society has changed its attitude towards immigrants. There was a time where immigration was valued and challenged. These days, we tend to, for political correctness sake, we tend to pander towards this community rather than challenge it. And that's where we feel as an organization that we need to step in and not allow that to take over, that kind of language to take over. We can't afford political correctness to be the rule of the day. And so 12 years ago, we opened up our first charter school because we thought, we think we can create a model for how you could educate immigrant children, and better yet, how do we go back to the old way of thinking as to what the role of the public schools is? And you think about why the public education system was created, and we're going back to colonial days, is that you had a new country. You had to create Americans, an American citizenry, and the public school system was supposed to do that. We don't do that anymore. We've lost sight as to what the public school system is really all about. And for a community that's as large as ours and continues to grow across the country, you have to ask yourself, how do we help this immigrant group transition to American society, successfully transition to American society, and dare I use the word, assimilate? And there I think that it's that word, assimilation, is very important to us. We shouldn't hide it. We shouldn't try to dance around it. Assimilation is an important process for every immigrant group that comes to this country, including Hispanics. And if we don't take responsibility for that, then we're going to be in bigger trouble down the line. And so we've chosen to take that approach, which, again, takes us in a whole different realm as an Alinsky style or inspired organization. In many quarters, people would say we're the antithesis of an Alinsky inspired organization. I would argue that actually we're more true to the model, because we tend to challenge our own. Our charter schools, therefore, became our foundation. We've always worked with the public school system, but there's nothing like running your own, where you get to hire your teachers, hire your school principals and directors, and develop a program directly for this community. 12 years ago, we began with one school. Today, we have 9 schools across the city. 4,500 students later, we've become one of the larger charter operators in Illinois, and probably the largest Hispanic-based charter operators in the country. We make no bones about what we're trying to do within our schools, and that's to help assimilate our families and challenge the system in a different way. A clear-cut example of what we do is very easily we could have fallen right in line with everybody else on the Hispanic side and immigration issues, and chosen to go to with a bilingual education model. As you may know, bilingual education is a transition program into English. You begin the first year of instruction in the children's native language, and every year you introduce a little bit more of English until finally the child has been fully transitioned into the English language. We don't do that. We immerse our kids in English from day one. And that could be a very controversial topic, and it is in some quarters. I would say it's more controversial within more of the activist groups, but it's not controversial with our families. Our families love the fact that their kids are learning English very quickly. And we see it not in terms of a political statement, it's just a reality. These kids are great kids. They can pick up anything very quickly if you do it well. And we have great teachers. And they do the heavy lifting every single day. But we're not going to use our schools to make that kind of a political statement about some other issue. We're going to try to figure out what's the best use of teachers' time, best practice, and instruct children. And we feel that an English immersion model works very well for this community. It always has. We were having a discussion earlier about the Catholic school system. Catholic school system has always been a great vehicle for immigrant communities. And certainly, English immersion is a model that they've always used. So that's one example of what we do. Our kids are in uniform. Boys wear ties. Kids walk in a straight line in the hallway. Very traditional school in that sense, that our parents love it, because it goes back to that, the idea that this is a very traditional community. And I'll say a lot of our parents love our schools, and for them, it just reminds them of what they had back home. You think of a school in Mexico or Latin America, that's exactly what you have. A very rigid, very disciplined, and very structured environment. Somehow we've lost that here in this country. And it's ironic that immigrants are saying, this is what we need in our school here. Well, this is what we give our kids and our families. And we're outperforming the schools, you know, the neighborhood schools. We're doing very well academically. And we're going to continue to grow because there's a big need. So to that extent, UNO is a controversial organization because we are challenging a certain status quo, but not in the same way that we think of a status quo. We think of back in the 60s, and a lot of the groups that would challenge the status quo is really challenging the system, you know, that kind of language. I think we do that as well, but we do it in a very different way. We really aim at helping to empower this community. And so if we use words like assimilation, if we do programs like English immersion, then you're starting to get into the realm of, well, what's the purpose of a school? What's the purpose of a community organization? If not to help people become successful Americans. And that's where we lay out the challenge to our families.
our citizenship program is really aimed at that. People come to this country not thinking that they're going to be here forever. Most people come to this country these days thinking, I'm going to come here, make a little money, and I'm going to go back. So that commitment isn't there to this country. The reality is that most people stay. And I'll give the example of my parents. My parents came here in the 1950s as newlyweds. They'd just gotten married. My dad told my mom, we're going to the United States. And their idea, like almost everybody else that comes to this country, is that we're going to be there a few years, make some money, come back, we'll be able to afford a house and all that. Those 3-4 years became 40-plus years. My dad passed away 4 years ago as an American citizen, very proud of being American. He wears the American flag on his lapel. And I think that what we try to do is challenge people to think, you're not going to go back. That's a harsh reality for people that come here with a certain idea and come to the realization that they've grown old, their children are born here, their children are not going to go back to anything. That's a harsh reality for people to encounter. But we feel that the sooner we face that reality, the faster we can get on with the business of the assimilation process. If you're in the middle of the road where you think you're going to go back someday, you're cheating yourself of that opportunity to fully invest in your community and certainly invest in your children, because your children are probably born here and they're probably not going to go back to a country they don't know. And so we set out to help people make that decision. And the best way to do that is by challenging people on their citizenship. Whether they're going to become American, they need to become American citizens. And what we found is that most of the barriers towards American citizenship are all up here. Some of them, these days, it might have to do more with money, because it's a very expensive prospect to go through the application process, several hundred dollars per person. But a few years back, it was like $90 to become an American citizen. And so what we found as we did a study as to what are the barriers that keeps this community from taking that step is it's just the notion that, oh, this is a very difficult process. This moment, do I have to go to school, learn about history and government, and take a test? Nobody wants to take a test for anything. And just the idea of having to take a test, maybe going back to school, and those people felt they didn't want to go through that, thinking that the test is very hard. It's really not very hard. It's who's the president of the United States? That's one of the questions on the citizenship test. Probably the hardest question is, what are the original 13 states? And you've got to memorize all of them. Most of us don't know them all. but it's actually a very simple test. But people don't know that, so they hesitate. People feel this guilt that they're betraying their home country by swearing allegiance to a new country. So it's a very personal decision. And then finally, people weren't being asked, why become an American citizen? If you're a legal permanent resident here, you can do almost everything an American citizen can except vote. You know, most Americans don't vote. And so really, why become a citizen? What we felt we needed to do is go back to the time where citizenship was just an expectation. You know, unfortunately, we're the beneficiaries of a lot of reform efforts. You used to have very strong institutions in our neighborhoods for previous immigrant groups. And in certainly a place like Chicago or Boston or New York, you had the benefit of very strong political organizations, but a tremendous self-interest to get new citizens, new voters. So that was their one main thing. They want these new people to become voters. We don't have that. So we don't have the benefit of strong political organizations anymore. The Catholic Church always played a very important role, and they have a weakened Catholic Church these days, mostly because of scandal and a lot of other things. We also are the beneficiaries of political correctness, of the sense of using the words of diversity and all that. Those are all good things. But we get lost within those words. We lose sight of what it means to be an American. And we're afraid to use the word of assimilation. We're afraid to use the term that we want to create new Americans. And so you couple all those things together, no wonder people don't become American citizens. That's not part of our civic culture anymore. And we felt we needed to change that. And so we set out to mount a campaign that would engage people in this discussion about American citizenship. Not so much in terms of rights. What are your benefits? What are the benefits of American citizenship? We couched it more in terms of what are your responsibilities. You're here in this country. Your children are born here. You're going to have a long future ahead of yourself. You have a responsibility to the success of this country, if anything, for the success of your children as well. And 15 years later, we've assisted over 80,000 people in our community to become American citizens. These days, every Flag Day, on June 14th, we celebrate a swearing-in ceremony at our schools, where 100 people get sworn in. Most of those are parents within our schools that we've identified that are interested and qualified to become American citizens. And in front of our kids, our gymnasium becomes a courthouse. The judge comes out and swears in 100 new American citizens. And it's a very inspiring, if you've ever witnessed a swearing-in ceremony, people might think that's a little jaded or get jaded with that, and you don't. It's a very inspirational moment where people, you can see it in people's faces. They never imagined themselves becoming American citizens, and they've earned that. They've worked towards it, and they've earned it. And I'm sure in the back of their mind, they're thinking all sorts of things about when they first came here, when they first thought of coming to this country, where they gave up everything to come here. And now they finally have earned this thing that a lot of us, unfortunately, take for granted. And I think that's what we try to do. Take those lessons, take the benefits and the assets that this community brings, this immigrant community brings, and how do we build on it? And how do we challenge them? The school has to be the foundation of that. If we can't provide a good education for our kids, that is going to be lost. And then, if we don't address the education part, if we don't recognize that we have a responsibility towards assimilating our families and our schools, down the road, 10, 15 years from now, considering the largeness of this community, we will have bigger problems. The problems that I discussed earlier, the gang problems, the dropout rate, just the dropout rate alone, will become a bigger problem and a bigger burden to the rest of society. And then we can look back and say, yep, this is a minority community. Yes, this is a disadvantaged community. Yes, this is a victimized community. And all those things we don't want to be. We reject victimization because it doesn't work. In Chicago, as I mentioned earlier, Chicago has thrived on the immigrant community, the Polish, the Irish, the Germans, and all of them. The Mexican community is the newest group, and it's poised to do great things. But those other groups also reject the victimization. They've never, ever embraced it as their model of empowerment. They've always seen themselves as being challenged, if anything, because there's just harsh realities as an immigrant community. We can't turn back and say, well, this is a different community. And I think, if anything, we tend to become victims of those terms. Somehow this immigrant community is different because, as I said earlier, we are people of color, and that means something else. And we shouldn't see this community in those terms. I think the success of UNO over 26 years is really a tribute not to our astuteness, it's really a tribute to this community, that when you challenge it, it'll rise to the occasion. It'll be there. It'll meet you where you want it to be. You have to have high expectations for it. And we've seen it. It has succeeded. It has all the right assets for it to succeed. We shouldn't turn our back on it, and we shouldn't pander towards it. And I think that's the strength of an organization like ours in Chicago. And everything that I say, in many quarters, could be very controversial. Let me assure you, it is not controversial with our community. They love to hear that, because that's what this community is really all about. So with that, let me open it up for questions. And in true Alinsky style, hope I agitated a few of you. Let's inspire some questions from all of you. So thank you very much. Yes.
I'm Adam Meyerson, the president of the Roundtable. Thank you so much for coming. I know that things are very busy in Chicago right now, so we appreciate your coming down. I have a question about what difference does citizenship make in the neighborhoods? If you start seeing a block where there are a lot of people becoming citizens, how does that change the neighborhood and the way they...
I think citizenship changes neighborhoods in the sense that we have people that are fully invested in that community. Prior to becoming an American citizen, again, these are folks that are legal permanent residents. They enjoy everything an American citizen does except the right to vote. So they get by. You can own a house, you can get a job, all the benefits. But something happens, and it's almost like a cliche. Something magical happens when you become an American citizen because you've earned that. And you feel that you have... Now you have to invest. Prior to becoming a citizen, you're like living two worlds. You're still trying to figure out if someday you're going to go back or whether you're going to stay here. The reality is you're going to stay here, but it hasn't clicked in yet. My parents, they came here in the 1950s. My brothers and sisters were all born here. We all grew up thinking we're going to go back. And that's hard to grow up in these two worlds, going back to something we've never even known. We go on vacation, visit family, but we don't live there. 2 weeks is not living there. But you grow up thinking that way. And people get by thinking that way. And what we try to do with the citizenship question is really challenge them about them making the decision that this is theirs and they have to stay here. They're going to stay here, so they need to start investing. So how that transforms neighborhoods, and it's the American dream to own a home. If you're thinking of someday going back, I'm not sure that you're going to buy a home. Some do. But once you become an American citizen, well, that becomes a very real question about home ownership and all that. Once you own a home, now you have a different thing going. You're not just renting an apartment. You want to make sure that that's your precious earning there. So you can invest in your community. You see your school in a different light, or your church. You're not transient anymore. Those are your institutions. So there is an investment that goes back that's missing when people feel that they're not fully invested. It's not theirs yet. I think that's how communities transform. And I think, again, it's not unique to our community. I think that's the story of other groups. The challenge that we have is that the proximity to Mexico is not very far. I believe when the Polish decided to come over, very different thought process. They're coming over for good. Certainly the Irish, right? There wasn't this thing that, well, someday when we go back. And mode of transportation, you get on a plane, you're there. You drive down 24 hours, you're down in Mexico. Very different times. But I think that's the benefit to you. It's a full investment in those neighborhoods.
What motivated your parents to make or how did the transition happen for your parents' generation to become citizens?
Well, sorry, my own parents, I asked them to, because nobody ever asked, why don't you become an American citizen? And by that time, we had begun our citizenship program, and I asked them, why don't you become an American? They became American citizens in 1992. They had been here since 1952, and that question had never come up in their minds. Nobody had asked. And I think what we do is really, and we have a broad campaign, media, the church. We have the church pastor say, next Saturday we're going to have Uno here to help you become an American citizen. It's important that you do that. That's a whole different thing. It's the church pastor saying that. And that's what the church doesn't do anymore. It used to do that. Your local alderman or councilman they used to do that. You know, when the precinct captain would knock on your door, they want you to become an American citizen. That doesn't happen anymore. And so it's really getting all of those people right back to where we once, what we once did. And again, for different reasons, you don't have those institutions as strong as they once were. But it's doable.
The very powerful work of John Dedrick from Kettering Foundation up in Dayton, Ohio. Once people have come through the citizenship test with you all, what kind of connections do you have with them afterwards? How do they act sure. with you? What kinds of things do they do?
In some cases, they do, not always. I think it's funny these days because we began our citizenship campaign back in the early 90s, early mid-90s. And so now we're known as a charter school operator. So now what we've done is merge the two. But I still encounter a lot of people that say, I became an American citizen with you, and now their kids are going to our school, you know, that kind of thing.
Do the parents then tend to be active with the school?
They do, I think, in many ways, because I think they feel that investment there. Again, not everybody becomes engaged with us. And that's not the expectation. I think the expectation is that they're going to live healthy civic lives to register to vote, be active in their church or in some activity at some level, take care of their neighborhoods, become a homeowner, those kind of things. And we promoted home ownership as part of our citizenship campaign as well. That's how we expect them. We don't say, okay, now that you've signed on, you're now a member of UNO, you're going to be active with us. Some will, and then there's a whole leadership development thing that we do as well. I think our expectation is that they're going to fulfill the expectations of what it means to be an American, a good American, in that way, that a good community, healthy community, care for your kids, be involved in your kids' schools. Yes.
80,000 is an extraordinary number, and so I certainly commend you. With regard to those who have become citizens, how many years would you say, on average, that person was still in the country? I guess I'm trying to understand if they already had a very good command of the English language. Or
Most of them, a big chunk of them, were from the amnesty days of the 80s. When we began our program, we did a study. We wanted to try to identify the barriers. What are the barriers? And we found most of them are just up here. There aren't these physical barriers. And ironically, we had a hard time selling this to the foundation community. Because, again, if you think of the Hispanic community and think of immigrants and all that, there's always this thought that somehow they're disadvantaged, and so, no offense to people here. There's a tendency to want to say, what's the barrier? What barrier needs to be removed? The barrier is really here, and it's really a question of how do you sell an idea? And the American citizenship is nothing more than a concept, an idea. Being American is an idea. There isn't something concrete. What do you get for being an American citizen? You get to be part of this, you know? And at that time, it was really hard to sell that to the philanthropic community because what's the barrier? What's the barrier that we would be asked? And so a lot of the folks, so we did a study to try to identify what are the barriers, and the barriers are just that people just didn't know that this is something that they should do. Just really organizing the key constituents and all that. So when we did that study, we determined that there was at that time about 140,000 people that either qualified or would be qualifying to become American citizens. The would be qualifying are most of the people that became legal residents. There's another dirty word. During amnesty back in the 80s, and so they had to fulfill their 5-year requirement as permanent residents, and then they could become American citizens. So when we began our campaign, we were targeting those, like my parents, that had been here for ages and never took that step. Because we knew once the amnesty people were ready, that was going to just filter into the process. And so it's a mix group. A good chunk of them were from that era that might have been here 5 years as permanent residents, not to mention whatever X number of years they were not. Most of these folks, their English is pretty decent. If anything, and here's the other fallacy. A lot of people thought, well, I have to go to school now. And so there's a lot of programs invested. Not that schooling is bad. It's a good thing. But that became a barrier because people didn't want to go to school. And some of these guys are 40, 50 years old. They don't want to go back to school. And so we try to make it easy by saying, look, this test is not that hard. See these 100 questions? Study them, learn them, you'll pass. And so these folks, and they will study this on their break time at work, at their factories and all that, and they would pass the test. We got criticized because we don't offer classes. I don't want to create more barriers for them. I want to make it easier and say, here, study this. And they'll take it seriously. And so some people, again, like my parents, had been here a lot longer. Others, much smaller time. But most of our folks were passing the test without a problem. The ones that would have a harder time were more elderly. There are some options for certain age requirement. After a certain age, you can take the test in your native language. Those that struggled were like elderly that didn't qualify for the number of years to be able to take it in Spanish, so they had to take it in English. That became a little bit more. But even those would be the ones that we would send to class. Take the class. You might need a little more assistance. Most of them passed it without a hitch.
Do you have the questions printed in both Spanish and English so you can look
yes.
at Spanish and then
yes.
you would know what
the Yes, English. It was just a booklet with 100 questions and answers, and we would work closely with the Immigration Department to get a sense of what questions would more than likely be on the test. And you had 100 questions, but they'd maybe have 5 to 10 questions that they would ask you on the test, not to mention a written part of just a coherent sentence. But again, most of the questions are very, very basic. What are the colors of the American flag? I think the hardest question was always, more for memorization purposes, what are the 13 original states? I'm like, okay, you got to go down the map in your mind. But other than that, and who's the president of the United States? And people, I always see my community as one that's, I don't undervalue it. I think it has great potential, and if I baby it too much, it becomes a problem. So we challenge it. We can do this, of course. You can do this, you know. Look, even with our parents, we may charge them a fee for something, and parents will complain, "Oh, it's a lot of money and all that. Are you kidding me?" Yes, by most standards, this is a poor community, and if you think of any stats and all that. But anybody that does their market research, any big company, the Walmarts and all that, they figured it all out. It's a great market. These folks spend tons of money, money they don't have. They shouldn't be spending. They will spend. And so the question for us is like, instead of spending that money in that big Escalade or the big Expedition, how about putting some money aside for college? You know, that's where we have to be telling them, help to guide them in their decision making. But it's a poor community. If you think of it in those terms, it's a minority community, it's a disadvantage because of all these problems, and it's a poor community. Yeah, our schools are about 93-94% low income. And we can treat it that way, but we don't. They rise the expectation.
Yeah. I'm curious about the charter schools. How do you fund them?
Charter schools are publicly funded schools. We get the same amount of money per child that any other public school will get.
And that's adequate.
I would say so. And here's the thing. For us, the biggest challenge on the finances is facilities. We have, in our community, because it's a large community, we have a severe overcrowding problem. Most of the public schools will turn over an existing building to a charter. Because it's sitting half empty, not in our community, they're bursting at the seams. And so that's why we rent from the Archdiocese. So we take the same money that the public school gets per child, and we have to take that and also pay rent. And so that takes some money off the program. In the last few years, we decided that we're going to go into the construction business and now build schools. But that's another big burden because we have to pay down the debts that the public schools don't have to pay. The neighborhood public school gets all its money in software programs. We got to pay down the debts. And so that becomes a challenge to charter schools. In Chicago, we are the largest charter school. We have the most Hispanic students in charter schools in Chicago because it's hard for charter operators to come into our neighborhoods, specifically because of the facilities issue. We've made it a challenge to ourselves to figure out how we're going to open up quality schools in our neighborhoods. So that makes it hard. On the education front, I always say, I don't need more money per program. If I need more money, I'll invest in my teachers. I want to pay my teachers more. And we're competitive with the union wages, but I want to be able to do more and challenge our teachers more. But not for programs. Right? We did a study recently, even with our own, and this is a good thing about charters, we get to challenge ourselves. We did a study on our summer school program. To me, summer school is a complete waste. Not because it can't be better, but I don't think we asked the right questions to what do we expect out of a summer school program. Our kids did not advance a whole lot with summer school. So why are we wasting all this money? And so last summer we didn't have a summer school program. And our kids weren't worse off. So we have to rethink what we do. I want to have a summer school program, but it has to have an intent, it has to have a product, and then an accountability for it. I think there's still a lot of ways with the public schools. It's hard to say that, like, we don't need a summer school for it. You know, what do you mean? No, I want a summer school, but it has to be a quality one, or else there's no point in doing it.
One more question.
Somebody else have a question? If you could say a little more about what kind of civics and class or social studies, how do you incorporate the citizenship theme into the curriculum of the schools? And also, forgive me if I missed this at the beginning, but your schools are named after veterans. Why is that, and how does that fit into?
And this is not something that we said. We're geniuses that we said 12 years, let's do this. And we're evolving over time. And one of the things that we decided to do more on the civics, American civics, and using the schools to complement our program in terms of citizenship and all that, there's just a tremendous opportunity. Look, we start out the year just like everybody else, the day after Labor Day. And the very first event that we celebrate that we honor is the events of 9/11. For the last 5 years, we have what we call 9/11 Remembrance Day, honoring local heroes. And we have each of our schools go out and identify a police officer, a fireman in our community that we're going to honor at each of our schools. We've been doing this for 5 years. And the thinking 5 years ago is like, our kindergartners weren't even born when the events of 9/11 occurred. For them, this is all ancient history, and that's how it becomes ancient history, because we don't realize that it's a whole new generation of kids growing up. So we have a whole program dedicated to 9/11 on that day, or that week, depending on what the school may be doing. I recently had a conversation with the 9/11 Memorial Foundation, and they were intrigued. Because we invite media to our school on that day, it's unheard of for a school to do anything on 9/11. And we're talking about 9 years ago. And don't even ask about Pearl Harbor or anything like that. We need to be doing that. And so from the onset of our school year, we begin with that. 9/11 Remembrance Day. Veterans Day is a big day for us. Our schools, we have three schools that are named after veterans. We celebrate Veterans Day. In that particular school, we are dedicating classrooms that will be named after veterans. So right now we're in the process of identifying 10 soldiers that classrooms will be named. And this is in front of our kids, and this is important, an important message. Thanksgiving takes on a whole different meaning when we have something to be thankful for. And you start thinking about, what has this country offered you? And kids are very smart. They understand what that means. But We all take that for granted. Between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we begin our charitable contribution. You'll get a kick out of this. We're a nonprofit organization. This is a 93% low-income population. Yet we raise our kids. We raise money for another community organization. We chose Misericordia Homes that deals with the disabled children and all that. Last year, we gave them $14,000. It's a coin drive. It's our way of teaching kids that they have a responsibility to give back also. So that becomes part of the norm. It's just that's the expectation. We honor leadership, Martin Luther King, President's Day. Those days should mean something. And all that, it culminates at the end of the year, our seventh graders go to our state capitol and meet our legislators. Our eighth graders go to Washington, D.C., to learn about government, see it firsthand. That's part of a series of things, and they understand it. We don't take it for granted. So we don't set it aside as this is the program. That's just part of what we do on a daily basis, and it's integrated within our program. Of course, we have a great math program, great reading program, and all that. But I'll say, even with reading, I want to make sure that our kids... and again, I harp on political correctness because I think that it has its dangers. I want our kids to be worldly. I want them to understand different cultures and all that. But also, there's something we said about Western civilization and all the great literature there. We shouldn't ignore that because we're trying to do something else over here. And that's important to us as well in terms of kids reading the classics and we make it a point. And that's why when I started earlier in the book, that UNO is an Olinsky, Saul Alinsky inspired organization, and that means something to a lot of people. And I would say, as much as we have our critics on the one hand that says, well, they're an Olinsky organization, on the flip side, we have people that say, well, they're no longer an Olinsky organization. We get it from both ends and all that. We evolve. We don't do the same old shtick, and we're evolving. Just like our community is evolving.
I know we're out of time, but when you say you're a Linsky inspired, what does that mean? It doesn't mean the Chambers period.
Yeah, actually, at Chambers, we know at Chambers. We say that because the organization came about in the mid-80s, and the idea was how do you build a power organization, much like an Linsky organization, for this new community that's coming up. And so it started out as we're not an IAF organization, Industrial Leaders Foundation organization, but we're pretty much modeled after that. Our trainings are about power and self-interest and all that. But we apply it in a very different way. And I know Alinsky organizations that would consider us, we've sold out the Alinsky movement. This is what works for us. This is what works for our community. I think there's some positives there, and I think that we don't want this to be a shtick. We want this to be very real. It has real results in our neighborhood. It's not a feel-good exercise. Our leadership development program that we have, and we do a lot of leadership development at the grassroots with our parents and the churches and the schools, but we also have a leadership development program aimed at Hispanic professionals, the lawyers, the bankers, and all. These are successful individuals. How do we get them engaged in leadership roles? And I'll tell you, it's met with a lot of success. Mayor Daley certainly sees this crowd as a group to tap into because these are successful professionals that understand the power dynamics in the public arena. So some of our graduates of this program are now heading up the Chicago Transit Authority. The president of CTA is one of our graduates. He's named, at least one of the aldermen is one of our graduates. This just happened this spring. So we're changing the power dynamics of Chicago as well. As much as we're impacting the local grassroots, we need leadership that's going to speak our language. Because if we have leaders that are speaking completely contrary to what we say, then that doesn't help us. And so we're trying to impact that world as well.
All right, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.